it was a continuation of that process, helping people understand that they could do something that was filled with adversity and challenges, but find a personal way to crack through. And for me, it wasn't about going back to Everest year over year, or going to do these big expeditions. It was about helping other people understand what they were capable of.
It's easy to talk about the successes, but what doesn't get talked about enough is the struggle. My name is Eric Weinmayer. I've gotten the chance to ascend Mount Everest, to climb the tallest mountain in every continent, to kayak the Grand Canyon, and I happen to be blind. It's been a struggle to live what I call a no barriers life, to define it, to push the parameters of what it means. And part of the equation is diving into the learning process, this process of growth and change and transformation that we're all a part of, and trying to illuminate the universal elements that exist along the way, like holds on a rock face that lead us forward and give us clues to why it's so important we get there. And that unexplored terrain between those dark places we find ourselves in and the summit exists a map. That map, that way forward, is what we call no barriers.
Today we meet Luis Benitez, who currently serves as the first state director for the Outdoor Recreation Industry Office for the state of Colorado. Luis has summited the top of the famed Seven Summits a total of 32 times, including being a six-time summiteer of Mount Everest. Years ago, Benitez spent a decade managing the well-established leadership development school Outward Bound Professional in Colorado, and he has also served as the COO and Director of Operations for Adventure Consultants, a highly respected New Zealand-based global expedition firm. Benitez has reported from Mount Everest for ABC TV News and has filmed segments for National Geographic on Mount Everest. What unites all of his work is a belief that if you really challenge yourself, you can truly change your world. Welcome, everybody, to our No Barriers podcast. We're really excited to have Luis Benitez with us today. We'll be getting to his story in just a few minutes here. Before we dive in and meet our guests, though, Jeff and Eric, you guys have been on many expeditions with the guests we're going to have, and in a movie together. Is that right? Were you guys part of a film? Is that right, Jeff?
We were, and matter of fact, probably a couple documentaries that followed some of our exploits together back when we were younger and more dashing.
Our guest is still dashing.
He's still younger and dashing than all of us.
Yeah.
Yes, it's true. But yeah, we've had a lot of experiences with Luis, and we've all kind of grown up together, so it's going to be fun. So I guess with no further ado, Luis Guillermo Benitez.
Oh, this is where I can talk now. Hi, everybody.
Hi.
I'm just biting my tongue, waiting for the intro. Thanks, Jefe. Thanks.
I just want to prop you up a little bit, though. A couple stats.
Wow. I'm going to sit back for this.
Seven summits, climbs, 32 of them. Mm-hmm. Mount Everest, six times, guiding it over and over and over. I mean, you're kind of, I think this is a cursing-free podcast, but you're kind of a badass.
Well, thank you. Wow. That's, I think, I can count on both hands the number of compliments you've given me over 20 years. And that's a big one.
But that's what good friends do. You don't really compliment each other, but you know that it sits there. You know that there's like this brewing respect that we have for you. And
that's true. You know. We were talking before we started that it's sort of this band of brothers that, I mean, I was a young, impressionable 28-year-old when we went to Everest, and I was 27 when we went to Amma de Blom. So we definitely have all kind of grown up together. And before the show started, I said, well, as you two age and wander gracefully into the sunset, I will still be young and dashing. And so I promise to take care of you guys.
I can't see you, but I hear you're still handsome, even though Jeff's gray and I'm balding. Mm-hmm. And Dave, I think Dave's still handsome, though.
I still remain young,
yeah,
comparatively speaking to this group here.
But I think one of the things that's going to be really interesting in today's podcast, many of you guys have listened to other podcasts where we've met adventurers, and we've met people who have done great things, but Luis has a really interesting combination of this adventure background, but now is in business and politics. And we're going to talk today a little bit about how those things all relate together, how they all come together. But maybe we could start, though, with some of the early days of expeditions, and tell us a bit. Oh, Jeff really wants to jump
in. I'm sitting back again for this one.
Well, no. I was just thinking to myself. You were talking about you being 28 and young and impressionable. If we were to roll back the tape, and if I were to told you that you would in 17 years from now be in the realm of state politics at a pretty high level, and would have been representing an entire industry in the political sphere. Maybe a couple of us may have believed it, but would you have believed that? Was this a trajectory that you thought?
Yeah, no way. I can remember all the conversations we had on that trip, and none of them included anything of this magnitude, I think, for any of us. I mean, I can point to you. Would you have considered doing the medic work that you've done all over the world and on Everest? Eric, would you have considered starting, helping to start No Barriers? I mean, I think all of us at that point were still trying to find our way.
We all had like $20 in our pocket.
Literally. Yeah. I mean, I came back from Everest and went back to work for Outward Bound and lived out of the back of the truck. Parked in the Leadville parking lot at Outward Bound Space Camp. I don't think any of us would have anticipated that.
Well, to Dave's question, though, give us a little backstory on sort of how we all came to be as one.
That's good. I mean, Diedrich, the expedition photographer from our Everest trip in 2001, and I, we were the kids, and we were sort of the outliers, because as you both know, Pasquale Scorturo, our expedition leader, you guys had all climbed together. You'd been on Denali. You had been on Kilimanjaro. You had done a bunch of other climbing together. And Pasquale, the expedition leader, had, and Eric, correct me if I'm wrong, a couple of slots that he could fill. And he knew Diedrich from a prior expedition in the Himalayas. And I was truly the oddball outlier. I had been to an expedition on this mountain called Gangaperna, which was in the Annapurna Range in 99, with a bunch of other Outward Bound instructors trying a new alpine route, first ascent with a bunch of 20-something-year-olds from Colorado, and we got our teeth kicked in. But our lead Sherpa had climbed with Pasquale on Everest and on Cho-Oyu and said, "Oh, you PV lives in Denver. You have to go back and bring him this present." And he handed me a duffel bag of stuff to bring back to PV. And I showed up at PV's door in his office downtown Denver, and I said, Pasong gave me all this stuff to bring back to you. What are you doing?" He said, "Oh, we're getting together with this blind guy. We're going to go climb Everest. It's going to be huge. It's going to be great." And I heard was Everest. I didn't hear blind guy. I didn't hear any of the other components. And I literally told him, "I'm going to be showing up in your office once a week trying to figure out how to get onto that expedition." And so I spent about a month lobbying and politicking PV.
So that was your first experience with politics.
And lobbying.
Yeah, pretty much. Now that I think about it, yeah. I mean, I think PV just gave me the go-ahead because he was tired of me showing up at his office begging for a slot on the trip.
Was it when you were on the flight over to Kathmandu that you realized there was a blind dude on your trip?
No, you know what? That's funny you say that, Jeff, because it – can I call you Jefe on this trip?
Okay. No one else will know who it is.
All right. When we were putting this together, a good friend of mine who had been a longtime guide said, "You realize that what you're about to do is a career killer, right? Because you're going to the Himalayas with the blind guy, and you're definitely going to get him killed. And as the guide who intentionally took a blind guy to the Himalayas, who's ever going to want to go climbing with you again? Because you're going to kill him, mm-hmm. and you're going to destroy your career. Like, this is a career killing move. There's a reason why they're bringing 27-year-olds on this expedition, because no guide with the resume would touch this thing with a 10-foot pole." And I sat back and like, "Well, no, wait a minute. Chris Morris, Jeff Evans, these guys are all pro guides. They're going." And I think that was really the first step of really understanding that we weren't just going to climb Everest. We were going to shatter that belief in what we could actually get done.
Luis, you weren't always an athlete. I remember you telling us stories about when you were a kid. Didn't you have asthma?
Yeah, no. I mean, I got lucky in a couple of different places, but I definitely was the boy in the bubble. I couldn't really go outside much till I was about 10. The doctors told my parents very, very clearly, just be ready to have a kid that, you know, leads a sedentary lifestyle, can't really go outside. His lungs just aren't built for it. And I remember finding a National Geographic article about the first American trip on Everest with Jim Whittaker, and that Jim had bad asthma and bad allergies as well. And his folks made him swim in lakes up on Mount Rainier and just kind of go hiking at high altitude and in the alpine zone. And that's what he attributed helping with his asthma. And I remember bugging my parents so much about this that we started spending summers in Ecuador, where my dad's from, hanging out in the high alpine huts at 15, 16,000 feet. And it was really an eye-opener for me that I wouldn't point to just that for getting my lungs back to where they needed to be, but it definitely helped.
Well, do you feel like the fact that the medical community and the world kind of told you that you were sort of quote-unquote weak and we're gonna live this sedentary life, do you feel like that propelled you in a way, or do you feel like that just has always been this backstory that you couldn't really identify with?
No, you know, and I don't know if we've ever, ironic that a podcast gets us to this real moment, I don't know if we've ever actually talked about this, Eric, but when we first started talking, because I remember you were doing some filming segment on ice climbing. Do you remember this at Boulder Canyon? You were looking for a belayer.
Yeah.
And PV's like, you got to at least go hang out with this guy and see if he can work with somebody that's blind. You can't just pick up and go to Alma de Blom where we're going to go first. And I remember going up we were done filming and shooting and climbing for the day, and the film crew was wrapping up and you were kind of off to the side. I didn't know at that point that you had bat radar and could hear everything that was going on. But I remember the film crew kind of dissing on you a little bit and like, like junk show, and, you know, whatever. Blind guy can walk and climb ice, big deal. And I remember thinking to myself that this is exactly what it was like to be a sick little kid, having people around you that didn't believe you were capable of doing anything, and that you should just sit in a room and not be allowed to even try. And it was at that moment that I really did. I knew that what we were about to do had very little to do with just climbing and a whole lot to do with breaking that perceived barrier of what you were capable of. So yeah, I mean, for me, it definitely turned into this journey of tell me I can't do it and I'm going to find a way to figure it out.
In fact, you and I summited side by side Mount Everest.
Yeah.
I said, you go first. And you said, no, you go first.
Yeah.
And I think then we said, okay, we'll just go together.
Yeah.
And we stepped onto the summit together.
Yeah, you know, that whole journey, like when I think back to all of us, and I clearly remember the sun coming up off the South Summit. And, you know, that storm that we had to live through in the middle of the night and watching Jeff bus trail and pull lines out, you know, at that elevation, like thigh deep snow along with Brad. Like we were all so motivated to do it together in an era and in a sport where it was every person for themselves, that still resonates for me to this day, that you can do right and do good and be awesome all at the same time. So just the fact that you and I got to summit arm in arm, that was just that was a byproduct of being where we were in terms of the climbing order as that day progressed. You know, that wasn't
like a little Hillary Tenzing sort of thing.
yeah,
we never said who summited first.
He shoved me out of the way and grabbed the rope and went to the top. So no, it was really special.
You went on to have, you know, a part of your career really dedicated to this expeditionary lifestyle. One of my questions as I kind of look at that part of your life is, we have many guests on this show that talk about a point in their life where they go on this transformative adventure or experience that forever shifts how they see themselves and the world around them. So can you talk a little bit about in those years where you worked for various organizations who did this kind of work, what you see as the value of these kinds of experiences for people?
Well, you know, it's kind of getting back to Jeff's earlier question, but that was the sum of my ambition. I just wanted to be a mountain guide and maybe own a guide service. And no offense, Big E, but after we came back from Everest with 10 fingers and 10 toes and seemed to be doing really reasonably well, everybody that wanted to go to Everest would call. And, you know, the fat guy from Texas, well, if you can get that guy up there, you can sure as heck get me to the summit of Everest.
Open the floodgates.
You know, and I think all of us that were guides, pro guides on that trip, Jeff, I know you've got some stories, and, you know, Chris and everybody else, like, we just started getting calls. And for me, because I was looking to really professionalize what I was trying to do, the companies were also calling as well. So ended up working for one out of Seattle, then became the chief guide and director of operations for one out of New Zealand. And I think it was just a continuation of that process, helping people understand that they could do something that was filled with adversity and challenges, but find a personal way to crack through. And for me, it wasn't about going back to Everest year over year, or going to do these big expeditions. It was about helping other people understand what they were capable of. And that took me a while to figure out, that it was less about building the resume and more about the education aspect.
A lot of people don't have the temperament for that, though. Like, they're great climbers. Like, you really you do amazingly well. The altitude, you're super strong. There's a lot of compliments today.
I was like, I can't even handle all
and
this.
And yeah, this is hard to handle. But some people just continue to climb, but you really dedicated yourself to guiding, like to really getting people to the summits of all kinds of mountains. That takes a special mentality and a special kind of service. And just one quick story I remember, and we'll get to this later, but I remember on one peak you turned a lady back, and you did it with the most incredible grace and empathy that honestly I think I've ever seen in my life. So how do you transform into that kind of service to others on mountains?
Are you talking about Ashley on Lobuchet?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I mean, I'm going to flip it back on you guys, and this may turn into a love fest, but that's fine. Jeff, you found a way to bring your brilliance into the world by being a medic on top of loving climbing the outdoors. Eric, no barriers, and you still climb and boat and do all these amazing things. And I still to this day can't get over the collection of all of us on that trip and what we've been able to do. You know, Eric, your dad says all the time, whenever I talk to him by email, we got to get some kind of a show. He's like, I don't know what it's going to be, but to revisit all of you guys and what you're doing now and your trajectory over that. Maybe this is the show to do it. And the trajectory over the last 17, 18 years, because we've all found a way to be of service to our communities and to the cultures that we love through the medium of what we did together all those years ago. And I think that that's, for me, the education part came from starting with Outward Bound here in Colorado. You know, I didn't just become a guide for the love of technical climbing, I became a guide from the love of being an outdoor educator. And so for me, that's a little bit of a different path to get to that end result.
But in a way, there you go. That's almost like the answer to Eric's question. You started as not like some, you know, crazy hard charging climber, but somebody who had a passion for teaching and getting the best out of an individual with the background of the mountains. Does that sound right?
Yeah. I mean, I was the 98-pound weakling for most of my childhood, you know, that even though I started to outgrow asthma 10, 11, 12 years old, I still wasn't running marathons, joining the track team. I didn't play football. I could barely throw a baseball or even shoot a basketball. Organized sports was sort of way outside the boundary of how I could interact and engage with people my own age. So got made fun out of a lot, got teased a lot. And when I discovered rock climbing at 14 and mountaineering at 15, that was it for me, because it really allowed me to understand that the capacity of what we were capable of and the connectivity of being a part of a rope team or having a belayer was groundbreaking for me, because all that trust, all that love, and all that education boiled into these intense moments. I couldn't get enough.
What was your best guiding experience, and what was your worst guiding experience?
Well, that's a softball question. I mean, come on.
Oh, not the blind guy to the summit.
Well, no.
Skip that, please.
Well, no, I'm not going to talk about Everest. I'm going to talk about Amma de Blom the year before. And I don't know how many people know this, that we went to Amada Blanc, which is a mountain just down valley from Everest, the year before Everest as a training trip. And the world, you thought the world was paying attention on Everest. People were really paying attention on Amada Blanc because like, oh, blind guy's going to the Himalayas. Let's see. He's definitely going to die. So let's see what happens. And with all that intensity and all that pressure and with a whole lot of testosterone on that, I mean, it was, you could barely get anywhere near our team that year. We were all young and hard charging and wanting to get it done. To make the decision to turn around because of objective hazard, when we knew how that was going to translate in the media and the climbing community, that it was going to be harder to find sponsors for Everest the next year, that turning back and being smart was going to make it even harder. You know, I was still pretty early in my career at that point, and watching and being a part of that whole process to pull the plug. And even when you said at base camp, you know what, I'm just going to hang out here. You guys go for it. Go ahead, summit. The mountain's all set up. You can keep going. And even then we said, "Not, that's not why we're here. We're done. We're going home." I had failed in the Himalayas the year before. I desperately wanted to get something on my resume that year to get my own professional track moving. And it was the greatest lesson and the greatest guiding moment of my career of knowing with all that pressure, with all of those things on the line for us to turn around. I reflected on that. There was one Everest trip where I turned everybody around just below the Hillary Step because the weather was coming in and it was looking pretty grim. And I definitely reflected on that day that it didn't matter. Media didn't matter. Reputation didn't matter. Because at that point, I don't work for you. I work for your family, and I'm not about to make that phone call home. And that trip in 2000 was probably the greatest guiding experience of my career. And the worst was in 2007 on Choyu for the shooting, the shooting on the border.
I had a note to ask you about that. If you could give us sort of the synopsis of that, because I feel like what I know of that experience for you, what was the overarching message there was truth. Mm. Like that's what I think about that when I reflect on you and your history, I think about truth. So tell us what happened.
Yeah. No, I mean, I was definitely at the height of my career at that point. I was working for Adventure Consultants, doing a job that I loved, getting to lead all the big trips. And Choyu is the sixth highest mountain in the world on the border between Tibet and Nepal. And there's a low pass right next to the mountain that Tibetan refugees use to leave Tibet, cross through Nepal, and get to Dharamsala, India, where the Tibetan government in exile and the Dalai Lama live. And you see refugees passing all the time when you're in base camp, and you know that that's just a fact of life. I mean, you hear stories now today, ironically enough, current state on our border with Mexico, and it's the same kind of stories. Families crossing, youth, adults. And you kind of know it, and it's sort of a daily occurrence. And when you're in base camp, you see it, and you don't really think much of it. And we were getting ready for our summit push, and I was in my tent, and I'll never forget this, getting ready to kind of leave base camp and head up the mountain for our summit push. And I heard what sounded like firecrackers outside. And our lead climbing trooper came in and said, "You have to come out. You have to see this soldier shooting. And you don't expect to hear a sentence like that on a Himalayan peak. And I came outside the tent, and all the climbers were kind of piling out of their tents and looking over towards the pass. And it's about a quarter mile away at 18,000 feet. We saw refugees running uphill away from Border Patrol soldiers that had knelt down in the snow and were shooting indiscriminately towards the refugees. And realizing that we were witnessing a human rights incident of extreme magnitude and with other soldiers streaming into base camp, I told our clients, since we were already walking out of base camp that morning, "Listen, let's head up the mountain. By the time we come down, the world's going to know because this is clearly an international incident. It's going on real time. There's a bunch of satellite phones in base camp. So let's just head up the mountain. When we come back down, you know, we're going to be in the middle of it, but at least the world's going to know what happened." And we came back down a couple of days later, and I started asking other expedition leaders what was the reaction to the global media, what had happened. Every single one of them to a person said, we didn't call it in. Like, we don't want to lose our permits. We don't want to lose our access. This is, listen, we employ Tibetans. We're helping here. It was a terrible tragedy, but don't speak up. Don't make waves." And that was incredibly hard for me because
were you literally like, are you kidding?
Yeah, I was, but still, you know, expedition leader representing a company, talking to these other expedition leaders representing their own companies, I got the business side of it. I got the dollars and cents. I got the employing Tibetans part. But what I didn't get was the lack of moral compass. What I didn't understand was how you could sit back as this multi-billion dollar economy that is the outdoor industry and allow something like this to happen and not speak up. So I got lucky. A friend of mine was at that point in his life an editor for an online adventure travel website, Explorers Web. And I emailed him and I said, listen, there's a story that had happened here. You got to keep my name out of it. I'm still in Tibet. Nobody's talking about it, but I'm going to write a story and you need to put it on the internet as is. Because it's still happening real time. We had soldiers in base camp that were kind of guarding all the expeditions. I did, and they did, and all hell broke loose. The soldiers started confiscating satellite phones, trying to figure out who broke the story. I won't bore you with the whole escape from Tibet thing when I had to leave and get out separate from my clients to make sure that they were safe. But I got ostracized within the guiding community pretty quickly for making waves and speaking up. So that was definitely the hardest guiding experience I've ever had.
Am I getting it wrong that they denied it, the soldiers? It was all denial, but then there was a video, turned out.
Yeah, so I had a Romanian cameraman on our team that had burned a hole in his tent and shot footage of the shooting and then ran to catch up with us and brought all the tapes up on the mountain so the soldiers couldn't, you know, when they were rooting around for camera gear and phone gear, couldn't find anything. And the story being spread by other guiding companies was that this was a prostitution smuggling ring, drug smuggling. They were right to shoot. And so at this point, when we got back to Kathmandu, we heard the Chinese embassy was looking for us. My name had been dropped that this is the guy that broke the story. So I checked into it's all very weird to think about now. Checked into a hotel under an assumed name and headed to the airport the next morning, didn't want to think anything more of it, didn't know what I had just done, and the phone rang. And you guys will know this, and it was Liz Hawley.
Mm-hmm.
And backstory for the listeners, Liz Hawley is this Himalayan historian who rumored to work for the CIA in the 60s, like knew where everybody was at any given time.
Edmund Hillary's girlfriend.
Yeah, like Sir Edmund Hillary's girlfriend, all these wild stories about her. She would be the only person that would know where I was at that point. And she said, don't hang up. I know the rumors that are being spread about what you saw. Would you like to actually meet the refugees that made it to Kathmandu? And so they sent an SUV and I drove on back streets to the refugee center, and I got to meet all of these kids who were being sent by their parents for a Tibetan education.
In Nepal, right?
In India.
In India.
Yeah. And we're kind of in transit in Kathmandu. Mm. And after I had done the tour and I'd met these kids who were shell-shocked because they'd watched some of their friends get shot and killed right in front of them, the director of this organization out of DC called the International Campaign for Tibet. And the director said, Luis, you've got a choice. You can get back in the SUV out the back door and go back to the hotel and go home and sort of stay quiet about it. You've done your part and we're really grateful. We've got video footage, which is the first witness crime against humanity out of Tibet in 50 years. So that's great. Or we've got reporters out the front gate and you can walk out the front gate and share the story. And your life will definitely change. I chose the front gate.
How did it change? I mean, how did that affect you? Like one with the facts, you know, but also physically, emotionally, and professionally.
Well, I mean, I'd like to say it was just this easy, morally driven high road that led to, you know, nirvana and nothing but good things, but it was incredibly hard. I had to step away from being the lead with Adventure Consultants, which basically translated to the loss of work because at that level, all companies sort of rely on each other. I get oxygen from you. You help transport my gear to base camp from your company. We're all connected, and I love the company that I work for, and I didn't want them to have trouble continuing to do the work that they did just because of my political stance. Came back to Colorado, started working became the director for Outward Bound Professional, which is Outward Bound programs, but for executives. So, because I thought if I was going to affect the moral compass of the industry and leadership for our economy, I had to be at a place where I was influencing what executives thought about how to not only make the world a better place, but how to do the right thing.
So instead of affecting just like, you know, a few people on your team who you're guiding, you're affecting hundreds, if not thousands of people.
I made a decision to try to amplify what I could do. But, you know, lost work, lost a lot of friends in the process too, who thought I should have kept my mouth shut. But then an interesting thing happened, and this will take about 60 seconds and then we can go on. So I split my time at that point between working for the International Campaign for Tibet out of DC, running Outward Bound Professional here in Colorado, and doing a little bit of guiding in different places all over the world with clients that had become friends. And I was getting ready to go back to Everest for what would be the last time there. And the phone rang when I was in the garage packing. And this guy said, "Luis, my name is Lodi Gary. I'm the Dalai Lama's special envoy out of Washington, DC. His Holiness has heard about the work that you've been doing with his people, and he would like to meet you." And I was, so, you guys know what it's like packing for expeditions when you're in the garage, you've got music playing. I was stupid enough to say, "Gosh, Mr. Gary, thank you very much. I'm so flattered."
I thought you'd be like, "Hey, is this Jeff? Is this Eric?
Yeah, that was the first thought that crossed my mind. Like, this definitely has to be Jeff or somebody else. But I said no. I'm like, I said, "I'm busy. I'm getting ready for Everest. If His Holiness is in Dharamsala in June, maybe I'll stop by." And I hung up the phone, and a good friend of mine saw me with my hand still on the phone, because I'm like, I couldn't really, it wasn't clicking what I had just did. And I explained the story. He said, "Oh my God, you've got to call him back." And at that point, you know, 2008, there was no call, you know, caller ID. I didn't know how to get a hold of him. Private number, and the phone rang 60 seconds later, and it was Kate, the director of International Campaign for Tibet. And she said, "Luis, pop quiz. When the Dalai Lama Special Envoy calls you and says that His Holiness wants to meet you, what do you say?" Of course, I backpedaled, apologized. And what was supposed to be a 15-minute meet and greet with a room full of all these other people due to scheduling snafus and cancellations when I was in Dharamsala, it was His Holiness, me, a translator, and two people from ICT, from International Campaign for Tibet. And I had the audacity to lament the loss of my job through this whole thing. I said, you know, I've lost friends, I've lost work. All I've ever wanted to do is be a mountain guide, and this is just completely...
I bet he pulled out the deepest, most awesome Buddhist thing, like, "Lost my friend is nothing."
I was expecting a Yoda thing for sure, but instead he laughed. And he kind of, yeah, pretty much. And
he's just like us. He laughed at you.
He did. Full, yeah, just like you guys.
Did he make fun of you too?
Yeah. Yes, he did. Matter of fact, Jeff, yes, he did. He said, "Yeah, you know, Luis, I'd like to be my people's spiritual and temporal leader still living in the Patala Palace in Lhasa, but you can't always get what you want," is basically what he said. But then what he said next changed.
That's so genius.
It just changed the trajectory of my life. He said, "Sometimes you don't choose your path. Sometimes your path chooses you. And now... it's up for you to decide what you want to be in the middle of all that." And that's really where it ended.
So that was, I mean, we keep going back to these moments that were potentially the harbinger of your political career.
Oh boy.
This is another one, right? Mm. I mean, it's like now it kind of all, if you really start thinking about the entire narrative of Luis, you see all these little pieces of truth and insight and failure and setbacks and developing into a voice that then sends you on this trajectory to where you are now, trying to create impact and influence, right, on a larger scale. So tell us where you are now.
Current job is as a director for the Outdoor Recreation Industry Office for the state of Colorado, working for the governor. So I get to oversee a $60 billion economy responsible for over 500,000 Colorado jobs. And through collaborative efforts with other governors in other states, try to build a coalition with states that have a version of my office and help encourage states to create the office to do just that. To provide a little guidance for the moral compass, oversee this gigantic economy responsible for a lot of jobs that the difference being does incredible work, not only for our natural resources, but also for that inspiration for who we are and what we do as outdoor adventurers. So for your first question, Jeff, yeah, if you would have told me way back then that I'd be doing this work, I would have laughed. But if you break down all these pieces that we've been talking about today. I wouldn't be ready for this job if all those things wouldn't have happened.
Yeah.
You had some coups. I mean, I know not just you, but your whole team and a lot of the industry brought the Outdoor Retailer Show to Colorado, which is gigantic. Tons of business for Colorado. Sorry, Utah audience members.
Well, Utah has my office as well. Tom Adams, the director, is a great guy, and we talk about this a lot. We talk about their political stance on public lands is one of the biggest things that allowed them to look at us. But the difference is, and I think this is important, the thing that they really landed on was the innovation and inspiration and thought leadership that we were willing to convene here in Colorado, that we may not have all the answers, we may not know the correct path, but we were willing to lean into difficult conversations when it mattered most, exactly like what we're doing here. And to their feedback, they weren't seeing that kind of forward-thinking momentum in any of the other states that were being considered. So incentives are one thing, but one of the realities of them choosing us was that ethic.
It seems to me that a lot of your career, Luis, has been focused on things that really, really matter, either to other individuals, you know, bringing Eric up to the top of Everest, to the clients you serve, to the story you just told about Tibet. Tell us why this work that you're doing right now matters so much.
Well, if you look at old pictures of Eric and Jeff and I and others on our team and climbing buddies and adventure buddies, I don't think looking at some of these snapshots or even at us right now on the live feed, you're responsible for a multi-billion-dollar economy driving millions and millions of jobs? There's no way. And that's the reality of how we've usually been seen or perceived up to this point. We're part-time recreationalists. We don't contribute to a community or a culture. We're part-time guides, be it on the river or in the mountains, hunting or fishing. We don't really do a whole lot. So the fact that we're now speaking through an economic lens, really validating who we are and the scale and scope of what we're capable of. You know, you look at other economies in the United States like aerospace or agriculture or any of the other components that really drive our national footprint. We're over 2% of the GDP for the United States. The Department of Commerce is actually counting outdoor recreation as our own silo for the first time last year. And that reality shifts our dialogue, both in DC and at the state level. Because for the longest time, I think our conversation has been steeped in conservation and stewardship. So when the outdoor folks would show up to a conversation, it was always perceived that you were there to hug a tree, save a river, protect a little bird that needed saving. But for the first time, we're showing up saying we are worth X amount of dollars, Y amount of jobs, and we're not asking for permission anymore. We're setting the stage and the tempo for the conversation around what our economy can and should be. And we're not just basing it in the economic standpoint, we're also looking at it from a leadership standpoint as well. That's why it's so important.
Blind fist bump.
Knuckles.
To YouTube.
Knuckles, baby.
What are the other states that have this department?
So right now there are 8 full states. So let's see. This is going to be a good test. Utah, Colorado, Wyoming, Montana, Oregon, Washington State, North Carolina, and Vermont. Michigan and Maine are coming online in January. And then you have a couple of bills and legislation that's out there right now for California, Arkansas, Kansas that are slowly coming online. So when I say that we're one of the few remaining bipartisan economies in the United States, we really are. This has nothing to do with political stripe and everything to do with the correct protection, promotion, and preservation of the things we love.
You've galvanized and helped given a voice to a lot of people that used to just be perceived maybe as environmentalists or hippies or mountain guides or whatever, right?
Yeah, but again, you know, and I keep throwing this back to you guys, but I don't know if you two go through this, but when you sit back at the end of the day and you look for peer leadership and mentorship and inspiration, you know, Jeff, following you on Everest when you did that medical show, Eric, you know, watching what you try to do with No Barriers and the kids in Tibet, which still to me, it's an incredibly personal journey. We don't take no or you can't or you shouldn't as an answer ever. And I find that leadership to be prevalent in our industry. And when you really think about the next gen of political leadership for our state and for our country, if we could actually show up with a little bit of that inspiration and goal setting and the opportunity to say, don't tell us it can't be done or it shouldn't be done, because we will find a way to make it reality. We don't have a lot of that right now, and I think that's something we can definitely provide.
You know how, you know, some people go to the mountains kind of to escape, but I've always thought one of the great importances of life is somehow figuring out how to take those experiences in the mountains or in the rivers or in the outdoors, beautiful places, and bring them back to our lives. So do you think you're connecting those things in your life? And how do you do it?
I mean, how the hell do you two find time to go out and adventure these days? I mean, it's the slow death, right? You represent and you stand for and you fight for all these things, and then you try to desperately find time to go out and seek inspiration yourself. And I've started to become more effective at mastering the mini moment. So I catch a story on social media about somebody doing something outside that really gives me heart. You know, being at the Outdoor Retailer Show in Denver three times a year, you know, that's 30,000 people in our ecosystem that show up with all of their own amazing stories. And I definitely have gotten to a place where, yes, I need time on my own outside to recharge my batteries, but I also need those stories, because I've become a collector of those stories. Because when people ask me why, or to Dave, your point of why would it matter, part of my job is retelling those stories. So this doesn't just belong to me, it belongs to all of us. And that's how I get inspiration.
Well, this has been a really exciting conversation about a diversity of topics that really matter, I think, to our listeners.
And a little stroll down memory lane.
Exactly.
You guys were really easy on me. I was expecting it to be a whole lot crazier, so thank you.
Well, the mic's going to get cut off here shortly.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so thank you, Luis, so much for joining us and
thank
for the incredible
guys.
Work you're doing right now for the state of Colorado and for the nation. Really appreciate having you here.
A pleasure.
Awesome, dude.
Well, guys, Jeff, yeah, I see you ready. You're ready.
Well, yeah, because once again, this is somebody that I've known for a long time, and it takes these kind of conversations sometimes when you're not sitting in a tent or in an airplane or at a bar. But you know that you learn these nuances of somebody that you thought you knew. And then the truth is, I can start to put these little pieces of a puzzle together to create this man that when I met him, he was a boy, and he's turned into this amazing man. And really the take home, and I reflect on it as a parent too, is the same thing I tell my son, is try to figure out a way to take all the things that you're good at and that inspire you, themes and behaviors that you put a lot of weight behind. And for Luis, it's to seek, it's truth, it's voice, it's commitment, and it's being aware. And he took all of these things and created this platform that benefits all of us. And I think that's an extraordinary skill to have. And I think for people that listen, that are still trying to find that galvanizing sort of place to go, the answer, per Luis, is to really just maybe self-inventory. What is it that's really important to you? What are you good at? It doesn't matter what. Just find it and then craft it and cultivate it. And then eventually it will turn into something. So I'm grateful for, Luis.
He did turn into something. Yeah. Kid with asthma, you know, kind of feels shoved to the sidelines, becomes a mountain guide, and then, you know, goes and does this courageous thing by calling out this bad thing that happened. And the Dalai Lama, I think, saying, hey, you know, I wish I was still in Tibet. What you do with it is what's important. And so, yeah, when you look back at your life, it doesn't really necessarily seem random. You know, it seems like when you respond in that sort of alchemy way, one experience is a catalyst that leads you to another. So Luis going back and becoming a leader at Outward Bound and then becoming a leader in Colorado, that's hard to do. It's hard to translate one experience of your life to the next. And you did a good job.
Yeah, and I think that concept of you do not always get to choose your path. Sometimes your path chooses you is such a powerful concept in our community at No Barriers. There's so many folks who are on one trajectory towards the life they think they're going to have, and then something happens completely unexpected. And sometimes it derails people, sometimes it propels them forward, and being kind of okay with where that path is leading, even though you haven't always chosen it, that really stood out for me. So another great conversation. Thank you, everyone, for listening. If you're wondering what you can do to support No Barriers, please like this podcast and share it with others. We do have an annual event every year that you can join us at, the No Barriers Summit. Our next one is coming up in Lake Tahoe in the summer of 2019. You can learn more at nobarriersusa.org. Thank you, guys.
Awesome. No barriers.
See you next time.
Thanks to all of you for listening to our podcast. We know that you have a lot of choices about how you can spend your time, and so we appreciate you spending it with us. If you enjoy this podcast, we encourage you to subscribe to it, share it, and give us a review. Show notes can be found at nobarrierspodcast.com. Special thanks to the Dan Ryan Band for our intro song, which is called Guidance. The production team behind this podcast includes producers Diedrich Jonk and Pauline Schaefer, sound design, editing, and mixing by Jesse Singer and Tyler Kottman, graphics by Sam Davis, and marketing support by Laura Baldwin and Jamie Donnelly. Thanks to all you amazing people for the great work you do. And soon they will be fighting.